The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Everyone hear that pretty well?
Very good.
It's good to see you all here tonight. Hopefully you enjoy the talk and hopefully some new information is gained and you'll see and find some benefit to yourself and to others as well. So many people assume that science and religion have always been at odds. This idea is often called the conflict thesis. This suggests that whenever science has advanced, religion has resisted. We hear phrases like the Dark Ages. Or people might bring up examples like Galileo being imprisoned, Christians opposing Darwin's theory of evolution. But no one ever asks, is this conflict true? Today we're going to explore the history behind this claim. And you might be surprised by what you find. I certainly was. I also want to spend some time helping us in how we can sort of reverse this perception when we have conversations with other Christians and also with non-Christians. I think it would be nice to equip everyone here with just some very short, easy ways to help make people question this concept when it's brought up around us. But first, let's look into who was responsible for this conflict thesis. On the slides on my laptop, that looked better. Anyway, two 19th century figures are largely responsible for today's popular myth of a constant conflict between science and religion. Those two people are John William Draper and Andrew Dixon White. So John Draper was an English-born chemist who contributed to multiple scientific fields. He wrote History of the Conflict Between Science and Religion in 1874. His conclusion is this: Roman Christianity and science are recognised by their respective adherents as being absolutely incompatible. They cannot exist together. One must yield to the other. Mankind must make its choice. It cannot have both. Now, the other person, Andrew White, was a literature professor who co-founded Cornell University in the US. And he delivered his influential 1869 lecture, The Battlefields of Science, and later published A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. And that was in 1896. Now, both these men wanted to free science from religious shackles and viewed Christianity as needing to abandon supernatural elements in order to be rational. Ironically, while demanding Christianity rid itself of myths, Draper and White invented their own myths about the religion and science conflict, and these persist even to today. They claimed Christians killed Greek science, plunged Europe into darkness, believed in a flat earth, and consistently opposed scientific progress. But all of this is simply untrue. Their flat earth argument exemplifies their flawed methodology. They cited two Christian writers, and only two Christian writers, 4th century Lactantius and 6th century monk Cosmas, as proof that the church rejected the spherical earth theory. However, these men were actually mocked by contemporary Christians. 6th century theologian John Philoponus criticized flat earth believers, and this is what he had to say about it. If certain people, owing to the uneducated state of their souls, cannot attain to what has been said and are troubled about the way the facts are put together, silence will help them to cover up their own ignorance. And let them not tell lies about God's creation out of their own lack of experience and the slowness of their mind. These two outliers had no influence on church thought. They were considered embarrassingly wrong even in their own time. Now, Cosmas is basically not read again for about another 800, 900 years before he is then rediscovered. But when he is rediscovered, it's more out of curiosity. So the idea that he was guiding anybody or the church's thinking is not even close to being accurate. So how do we know this is false? How do we know the church didn't believe in a flat earth? Well, apart from that quote before, Greek natural philosophy texts were actually preserved in monasteries of the church. The vast majority of classical literature that we still have today is because monks, scribes, and anyone else involved in the church who had the ability copied them down and preserved them in the monasteries, which eventually became our very first universities. Universities like Cambridge and Oxford. You have John of the Holy Cross, who wrote a textbook in the 1500s called The Sphere, which was used in medieval universities, and it teaches how the world is round. Some might object that it was only the intellectuals of that day and not the general population that believed this. But that doesn't match up either, because popular works of the time, like Canterbury Tales, Mandeville's Travels, or even Dante's works, have a spherical earth in them as well. And they were just pretty much read by everyone, the general populace. So there are probably more people alive today who believe in a flat earth than there have been in the last 2,000 years. So the medieval church did not teach a flat earth, it held to a spherical earth. But they did insist the earth was the centre of the universe, right? After all, they persecuted Galileo for saying the sun was at the centre. But let's look a little closer into that. Galileo was a Copernican, which simply means he believed the sun was the centre of our universe. The church did bar Galileo from teaching that the earth revolved around the sun, but Galileo continued to teach it and eventually found himself on trial. But here's how Draper puts the story in his conflict book. On his knees with his hand on the Bible, he was compelled to abjure and curse the doctrine of the movement of the earth. What a spectacle. This venerable man, the most illustrious of his age, forced by the threat of death to deny facts which his judges as well as himself knew to be true. He was then committed to prison, treated with remorseless severity during the remaining 10 years of his life. So it doesn't sound great for the church here at all. But the truth is that Galileo was actually supported by the Roman Catholic Church for a very long time. His scientific work and achievements were praised. The Roman Catholic Church was a patron of Galileo for a very long time. However, some animosity did start to grow between the church and Galileo, but not because of his science. You need to look at what else was happening around that time to better understand why they had issues with what he was saying. The first consideration is that Galileo was speaking out and publishing at a time just after the Reformation. So the Roman Catholic Church was dealing with the external conflict of the Reformation when it came to the Protestants. But there were also many instances of reform movements within the church as well. So the papal state was under a lot of heat, and Galileo was not very diplomatic at all. He ended up insulting the Pope, who had actually supported him for a very long time. Not the smartest move. So when Galileo came out and said he could interpret scripture better than the Catholic Church to fit his heliocentric view, I think we can understand why that might not have been received very well. He wanted to challenge them on this issue, but had not yet definitively proven his science. The church told him once he could definitively prove this theorem, they would accept. But Galileo was also throwing up a few other theories that ultimately were proved wrong. So Galileo was also incorrectly challenging the church on matters that he ended up being wrong about. With his heliocentric view, he also had religious supporters. And so when we look deeper into this, we have to start asking, was this a science religion controversy, or was it something else? Ultimately, it was between two competing versions of science, not competing against science. Unfortunately, the church backed the wrong side. So that's one element of it. But you've also got to look at the fact that Galileo had religious supporters. So this just further emphasizes how much this conflict had nothing to do with science being suppressed by religion. But was this reaction to Galileo typical of the Catholic Church at the time? Not really. It was actually pretty out of keeping with the way they tended to deal with science and philosophy. And the Catholic Church gave more support to the study of astronomy from the 14th to about the 18th centuries, more than any other single institution, and to be fair, probably more than all institutions put together. But what about the idea that Galileo was tortured and imprisoned? Well, guess what? Also false. He was not tortured. There's no evidence that he was tortured at all. Now you might say, but the Catholic Church surely wouldn't keep evidence of that stuff. Weirdly, they did. They actually kept very good records of people they arrested and tortured. So if they did, we would have known. And his imprisonment was a palace, mansions, and house arrest in his Florentine villa. Someone please come arrest me now. But it was also with a bishop friend, a bishop of the Catholic Church. I'm pretty sure he was even afforded a live-in butler. So even during the sort of inquisition towards Galileo, he was still put under pretty comfortable accommodation. He was not put in a dungeon or a prison. He was not put on a rack and burnt. He was living with a Catholic bishop who was a friend. This is hardly being rejected and ignored by the church. But why was his view rejected? Well, looking at the political movements of the time, you have to consider the internal religious changes going on at that time, like the Reformation. And you have to also consider Galileo's own personality, which at times seems quite arrogant. So the story is messy. And so it means we have to hold several things in tension with the story of Galileo. Yes, he was put on trial for advocating that the sun was the centre of the universe, and that was the church being a bit dumb. But no, he wasn't tortured. In fact, his major treatise on motion, called Two New Sciences, was written after his trial while he was in house arrest in his villa, sold out immediately in papal Rome. So it's hardly him being ignored and suppressed. About 100 years before Galileo, in the early 16th century, the church was accused of putting up another major barrier to scientific progress, this time in the field of medicine. Have a listen to this from Andrew White's book, Warfare. Had not such men as Thomas Aquinas, Vincent of Bovis, and Albert the Great been drawn or driven from the path of science into the dark, torturous paths of theology, leading nowhither, the world today at the end of the 19th century would have arrived at the solution of great problems and the enjoyment of great results, which will only be reached at the end of the 20th century and even in generations more remote. Diseases like typhoid fever, influenza and pulmonary consumption, scarlet fever, diphtheria, pneumonia and the gripe, which now carry off so many most precious lives, would have long since ceased to scourge the earth. According to Andrew White, the church is apparently responsible for the deaths of millions of people by stunting the growth and practice of medicine, by distracting some of the world's greatest minds with silly theology. White seeks to demonstrate the point by claiming the church banned dissections of the human body and the use of anesthetics. But again, this is a myth. It was actually the church that first legalized dissections. I think I've skipped one too many. In a pivotal collection of essays on the alleged conflict between religion and science called Galileo Goes to Jail, Catherine Park, a professor of the history of science at Harvard, wrote that the idea that the church banned dissection was a myth that just won't go away. Pope Boniface VIII did issue a papal bull in 1299, which forbade a funerary practice where you cut up the corpse and boil the flesh off the bones so you can easily transport the loved one over a greater distance. Now, this is a pretty gruesome procedure that in the Pope's mind threatened human dignity. But the Pope didn't have medical dissection in mind when he said this. The fact is, no anatomist was ever prosecuted for dissecting a human cadaver, and no case has been found in which the Church ever rejected a request to do a dissection. Catherine Park notes that there was a general public reluctance to donate bodies to science, but this was more about cultural sensitivities around dishonouring a loved one rather than religious prohibition. And I think we can understand why. In the 1500s, dissections began to happen before a gathered audience. Guards had to be placed at the doors to restrain an eager public. There was an entry fee. And the dissection would also be accompanied by a musical performance. Religious or not, I think most of us would probably object to our loved ones being part of something like this. So for Draper and White to say that religion held back medical discoveries because the Church refused medical professionals to complete autopsies is just wrong. The only objection from the general public was with public dissections. So what about pain relief? What claims did Draper and White make against the Church on this one? Well, when James Simpson discovered that chloroform was an effective anaesthetic in the 19th century, he rightly predicted it would turn the world upside down. But according to Andrew Dixon White, the Church opposed this as well. He wrote in his History of the Warfare of Science and Theology these words: "From pulpit after pulpit, Simpson's use of chloroform was denounced as impious and contrary to Holy Writ. Texts were cited abundantly, the ordinary declaration being that to use chloroform was to avoid one part of the primeval curse on women." Here Draper is referring to Genesis 1, where the common view was that one of the punishments on Eve for eating the forbidden fruit was a painful childbirth. Amongst scholars, this has pretty much been denied. I would have gone into more of it, but when I did, I realised that's a whole talk on its own, so I stopped. Now, it is true that you can find one or two sermons with pain relief in childbirth and their disagreement with it, but the only people that really actually sort of objected to this straight up were doctors. It was the doctors who opposed it. The Church was broadly in favour of it. And the reason why doctors opposed it is they were worried that if a woman was asleep during childbirth, she wouldn't be able to push properly and it might cause damage to the baby and or the mum. Which I think is a very valid concern when a new technology like this first came up. But when it was shown that this could still be done, all that opposition quickly dropped away. So the gap between pain relief first being used and then being completely accepted by everybody is actually a very, very short time. Now, Simpson himself did write a pamphlet to defend chloroform against any religious opposition, but it's widely accepted these days. He did this to preempt any objections, not because he actually got any pushback. Overwhelmingly, Simpson received positive responses from Christian leaders. Even from the limited evidence provided so far, I think it becomes obvious that no one who genuinely knows the history of the Middle Ages could suggest that the Church buried its head in the sand and ignored the life of the mind. But what about Jesus? When you read the Gospels, it's pretty clear he didn't have much time for the sophisticated legal and educated traditions of the Pharisees. Jesus ridiculed the Pharisees for being too worried about the intellect. And yeah, he did, but he also sort of didn't. While he did ridicule the Pharisees for being legalistic, Jesus also put the pursuit of intellect at the center of the spiritual life with a focus on loving God with our whole being, including the mind. Quoting the Old Testament, Jesus said that the greatest command of all was to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The love of God, in other words, is not only a thing of the heart and a thing of the soul. It's not just about striving with our moral and practical strength. We are explicitly urged to love God with the whole of our mind. Loving God involves using our minds to know God and His world. Someone who doesn't think deeply about the world, about relationships or how to live, and about the nature of God Himself isn't loving God with their whole mind. The impact on this, of this on the first Christian communities was instantaneous. Our earliest writings after Jesus are the letters of the Apostle Paul, some of which are dated to within just 20 years of Jesus. Years ago, Roman historian Edwin Judge wrote a couple of papers outlining why, on the basis of the letters of Paul, he thought people outside the church in those first few decades would have understood the church as a school with teachers and a set curriculum. And it's a point that has been underlined in a really detailed way by a local Australian New Testament scholar named Claire Smith. Her published doctorate outlines the surprising prevalence of formal teaching and learning vocabulary across Paul's early letters like 1 Corinthians, and also in his later ones like 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. And in the next century, this intellectual tradition only grows. It's a little known fact that the early church took Christian education extremely seriously. The apostolic constitutions required a 3-year program, with converts receiving extensive instruction before baptism. We still have some of those lectures, like those composed by Bishop Cyril of Jerusalem, showing the rigorous intellect preparation that the early church demanded of its followers. This loving God with all your mind never stopped the church of late antiquity and in the early Middle Ages. Contrary to popular perception, Christian clergy and monks studied and copied a vast array of both Christian theological texts and ancient Greek and Roman literary and philosophical texts. The Church of the Middle Ages was the great storehouse of knowledge. Not just knowledge about theology and canon law and stuff like that, but about astronomy, music, rhetoric, logic, and much, much more. And it doesn't seem like there's a way you could drive a wedge between a monk's Christian faith and their passion for knowing stuff about the world. To these medieval zealots, faith and knowledge are basically the same thing. Their love for God motivated them to know God's work in the world, and it was all considered worship. The level of scientific knowledge during the Middle Ages was actually quite extensive. For example, we have a letter from Alcuin of York trying to explain to Charlemagne, the great European king, that the regress of Mars in the night sky is not a spooky sign of doom, as Charlemagne feared, but that it's an entirely predictable pattern of celestial movements, perfectly in line with the orderly mind of the Creator, And this was back in the 700s. First off, does anyone here know what any of that meant? And do you think you could do the math to figure it out? I wrote it and I still don't know what it meant. So by the 700s, which are meant to be the Dark Ages, this great intellectual and church deacon named Alcuin of York designed a program of study that traversed grammar, rhetoric, astronomy, arithmetic, philosophy, music, and so on. And under his guidance, Europe experienced an explosion of schools that far eclipsed the educational programs of the Roman Empire. His schools were the ancestors of the European universities. And anyone who takes the time to read his letters, of which there are over 100, they'll discover that he did all of this in Christ's name. He was convinced that the so-called liberal arts were tools by which we can comprehend God's world. But he was not alone. Bishop Robert Grosseteste, who was the Bishop of Lincoln, woke up one day and started to contemplate where matter came from. And so he's sitting there in his room and looking at light coming through a window, and he starts to think, when light comes in through a window, it expands to fill the room. And so he theorized that the universe may have begun just as light and only as light. And then the light somehow condensed into solid matter. And he said it's what gave it the ability to expand from a single point. And he's saying this in the 13th century. Look, it's a little bit naughty to say that he's anticipating the Big Bang theory and the expansion of the universe and the formation of galaxies. But he is exhibiting scientific theory and scientific theory that closely resembles a scientific discovery which would take another 700 years before being fully explained. Similarly, the foundations of genetics, crucial to understanding evolution and a whole heap of other science stuff, was actually laid by Gregor Mendel, an Augustinian friar who conducted his famous experiments in his monastery garden. Through careful breeding of pea plants over 8 years, Mendel tracked how traits like plant height, flower colour, and seed shape passed from parent plants to offspring. His meticulous record keeping revealed mathematical patterns in inheritance that became the basis for our understanding of genes and heredity. These ancient and medieval Christians understood that the more you discover about literature or astronomy or the offspring of pea plants or any other topic, the more you understood, the more you were participating in the wisdom of the Creator. They saw this as what it means to love God with all your mind. In more modern times, Christians have been at the forefront of scientific discovery. Georges Lemaître was a Belgian Catholic priest, scientist, and mathematician who had a significant influence on the fields of cosmology and astrophysics. He was the first to suggest that galaxies moving away from us is evidence that the universe is expanding. This idea, based on his work with Einstein's equations, led him to propose the hypothesis of the primeval atom, which later became known as the Big Bang Theory, the explanation for how the universe began. Lemaire studied subjects like engineering, maths, physics, and philosophy at the Catholic University of Louvain, and became a priest in 1923. His mentor, Cardinal Mercier, encouraged him to pursue science. This caused Lemaire to travel to England and work with the famous astrophysicist Arthur Eddington at the University of Cambridge, and to the United States to work at Harvard and MIT. From 1927 to 1964, Lemaire was a physics professor in Belgium and was one of the first scientists to use computers for research, pioneering this new technology. In the 30s, he and another scientist, Manuel Sandoval Velata, showed that cosmic rays are affected by Earth's magnetic field, proving they carry an electric charge. In 1960, he was honoured by Pope John XXIII and became president of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, a role that he held until he passed away. Unfortunately, this conflict between science and religion is perpetuated by Christians because of their fundamental belief of a conflict between science and religion. Some Christians dismiss the Big Bang theory and evolution without adequate study, assuming it threatens biblical creation accounts because they believe that this is the goal of their scientific endeavours. This represents a tragic irony. By believing the myth that faith and science are enemies, some modern Christians actually fulfill that false narrative. Our defensive reactions to scientific discoveries inadvertently give credence to the very lie that we should be rejecting. This reaction makes Draper and White's fabricated conflict appear real. But if we can reclaim the Christian tradition of seeing scientific discovery as the pursuit of loving God with all our minds as a form of worship, we can expose this false narrative and restore the church to where it has always belonged, at the forefront of scientific advancement. Take the Big Bang Theory as a perfect example. Developed by a Catholic priest, it actually provides compelling scientific evidence for what Scripture has always claimed, that the universe had a definitive beginning. Rather than Christians opposing this discovery, we should recognise it as a powerful confirmation of biblical truth. We should see it as a win for us, because that's how atheist scientist Robert Jastrow saw it when he said this in his book, God and the Astronomers. Now we see how the astronomical evidence supports the biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definitive moment in time, in a flash of light and energy. Robert Jastrow actually went even further. He said this in an interview with Christianity Today. Astronomers now find they have painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in this cosmos and on the Earth. And they have found that all this happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to discover. That there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. Now remember, this comes from an atheist scientist. This is not a believing scientist. When we approach science with careful study rather than knee-jerk reactions, we often discover that new knowledge enhances rather than threatens our understanding of God's work. Even today, we have Christians like John Lennox working at world-renowned universities like Oxford and having an impact in the mathematical and scientific worlds. Christians in the church have been and still are at the forefront of Christian advancement, and it doesn't look like it's going to stop. Many Christians work in evolutionary biology, physics, AI, and other scientific disciplines. No discipline of science is without Christians continuing the advancement of these fields. Religion has not suppressed science, but throughout history has actually been the reason for scientific advancement. So how do we respond? Now that you know the real history, how do we actually use this knowledge? Well, here's four practical strategies. First, ask questions instead of making statements. When someone says religion has always opposed science, try asking, which specific example are you thinking of? Most people will probably mention Galileo and the flat earth and Christopher Columbus. Both stories you know the real facts about. Questions expose the weakness of their position without being confrontational. You can tell them that only two Christian writers ever said the earth was flat. You can also say they were highly ridiculed in the church and were considered laughable. Even just stating the fact that everyone knew the earth was round even before Jesus was born is a good place to go. Second, flip the narrative with positive examples. Instead of just defending against attacks, you can go on the offensive with some facts. You can ask them, did you know the Big Bang Theory was proposed by a Catholic priest? Or the first universities were actually founded by the church to study God's creation, and that they were also responsible for the study of science, mathematics, philosophy, reason, music. So we can lead with these surprising truths that might challenge their assumptions. Third, correct the term Dark Ages. Historians don't use it anymore. When someone mentions the Dark Ages as evidence that Christianity plunged Europe into darkness, you can respond. You can respond by saying historians actually call it the early Middle Ages now. And the challenges of that time came from the collapse of Roman infrastructure and the barbarian invasions, not the church suppressing knowledge. You can let them know the only reason we have any of the information from the Romans and the Greeks is because the church protected, reproduced, and copied these documents. And so without the church, so much of these ancient documents would be lost to us. Fourth, you can acknowledge the complexity while rejecting the myth. You can say something like, sure, there's been tensions and disagreements, but the idea that religion systematically opposed science is a 19th century myth that doesn't follow and match the historical record. You can mention that all scientific endeavour was done to better understand how God created the universe. Hopefully, this has made you rethink the importance of your minds when it comes to faith. Hopefully it has enlightened you to how much science has been influenced by the church, and hopefully given you a bit of confidence to correct both Christians and non-Christians who spread this myth of conflict. But I also hope that as science makes new discoveries, we don't make the same mistakes we have made in the most recent past. I hope we don't quickly jump to conclusions and dismiss scientific discoveries and miss how this new understanding may actually point towards a creator if we actually take the time to think. Hopefully, as science discovers more about what God has created, we can point more and more people towards the wonderful creation God has given us to explore. Thank you. I will now open it up for any questions.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.